6.
Radio Buddhist Youth Association. Good afternoon, everybody. You are listening to the sound of universal compassion. Today, 6th of November, we will continue listening to Tenton Chosen's previous program with the book Way of Life by Shanti Davies. And please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3 or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146 Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271 3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello and welcome to the program today. I hope your week has been fruitful and happy. Last week, we started considering the text, The Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, by the great Indian scholar and yogi, Shantideva. For those who are not with us, this is a practice manual for bodhisattvas. That is, people committed to attain enlightenment, to be of the greatest benefit to all other beings, as they strive to free themselves from suffering and attain long-term happiness. That commitment is called bodhicitta. And basically, Shantideva's work tells us how to make the commitment and then how to act on and strengthen it. Last week, we looked at the introductory 3 verses of the first chapter, which extols the benefits of bodhicitta. In those verses, Shantideva paid homage and explained why he intended to compose the work. Now, before we go on with the text, let's, as usual, set our motivation. Remember that the motivation defines whether an action is positive or negative, whether it will lead to happiness in the future or suffering. For instance, we can participate in this Dharma discussion just to gain some temporary immediate benefit. I may think that if I participate in this program, people will praise me for being such a spiritual person. They will think I'm special in some way. This motivation is mainly concerned with a short-term worldly happiness. And so it's not even a Buddhist motivation. It makes the action small and self-centered, and any benefit I'll gain from such a motivation will be short-lived. The action certainly will not lead to long-term happiness or enlightenment. In fact, when this life is over, any benefit will have disappeared, and I will be left with a karma motivated by self-interest. And that inevitably leads to future unhappiness. How much better, then, if we can set a motivation that will make the program work for us until we reach enlightenment, even if it takes 10 million lifetimes? Bodhicitta gives us such a motivation because its focus is all suffering beings everywhere. The action is dedicated to their welfare as I take on the responsibility to attain enlightenment to help them in the best way I can. As the object of this motivation is vast numbers of beings, actually uncountable, the scope of the motivation is similarly vast. The benefit is not only for one person, but great multitudes, so the positive potential is also huge and long-lasting. As this is so, and as this series of programs is on bodhicitta, let's set a motivation to participate, not only for our own benefit, but to attain enlightenment to be of the greatest benefit to all other suffering sentient beings. However, if that is too much for you, at least set a motivation to gain enlightenment for yourself. So then you, at least, will be completely free of dissatisfaction and misery. Thank you. Now back to Shantideva's text. As I said in the previous program, I'm using Stephen Batchelor's translation for this work, for it was originally written in Sanskrit. You'll find many translations into English now, but one of the first, and still possibly the one closest to the Shantideva's intention, is this one by Batchelor, though it's not the most poetic. If you want to buy this book, it's available on Amazon or the Book Depository, where you'll find other translations as well. Batchelor's text is not very well bound, and the pages tend to come apart, so if you're going to buy it, I suggest you get a new copy. You can also download the text from the website www.abuddhistlibrary.com. A Buddhist library, all one word. After having introduced his intention and undertaken to compose the text as we described in the previous program, Shantideva talks about the transitory nature of this life and death as our constant companion. It goes like this. Leisure and endowment are very hard to find, and since they accomplish what is meaningful for man, if I do not take advantage of them now, how will such a perfect opportunity come about again? Now, how many forms of life do you think there are on Earth? It's a huge number, isn't it? Think of all the animals, all the insects, the fish, reptiles, and birds. There are so many that the scientists haven't discovered and described all of them yet. And even one species may contain an uncountable number of individuals. I've read of one colony of ants in Europe that stretches for 6,000 kilometers from Italy to Spain. And it is only one part of a more massive super colony that also has colonies in Japan and California. Normally, ants from different colonies will fight each other. But when researchers introduced ants from the huge colonies in Japan, Europe, and California to each other, they acted like old friends. This led the scientists to conclude that the ants in those three colonies actually all belong to the same super colony. My point is that thinking of forms of life on Earth, we can soon get a headache, because there are so many, and people only make up a small number of the total. Of all the people, not that many have heard of the Buddha's teachings, and of those who have, only a relative few have the opportunity to really practice and fully realize the teachings. Tibetan Buddhism lists 18 conditions under the two terms leisure and endowments that are necessary for meaningful practice. And this is what Shantideva is referring to in the first line of this verse. Of the 18 conditions, 8 fall under the heading leisure or freedom, and 10 are endowments. We went through all these freedoms and endowments at the beginning of the previous series of programs, but I wonder how many regular listeners remember them and how many new listeners know of them. I think it'll be helpful to go through the freedoms and endowments again, so we all know what Shantideva is talking about. The first four freedoms refer to places we could have been born where it would be difficult to practice the Dharma. As you know, Buddhism defines the realms of unenlightened existence in 6 broad categories: hells, pretas, animals, humans, devas, and gods. The hells, of course, are states of great torment, and in the 130th discourse of the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle-length discourses, Buddha describes 8 hot hells, 8 cold hells, and a number of occasional and surrounding hells. I'm not going into them here. If you want to know more about them, you can find descriptions on internet sites like Wikipedia and in texts like Geshe Loden's The Path to Enlightenment in Tibetan Buddhism. If you're born in a hell realm, you undergo such suffering that it's virtually impossible to even think about the Dharma. For a rough example from our world, if you're caught up in a car crash and the car you are trapped in is on fire, as you burn, it's very unlikely you'll be thinking of Dharma practice. So being in a hell is like that, but much worse. Caught up in intense suffering, beings can only think of the pain they're going through. The first leisure is the freedom from being born in such a state. The second is freedom from being born in the preta realm. Pretas are creatures that are basically can never find any satisfaction. They're characterized by being ravenously hungry and thirsty, but hardly ever finding anything to eat or drink. Or even when they do, it's impossible to reach or to consume due to various obstacles. As an illustration, we might think of people starving and desperately thirsty, stranded in a desert, and who see water and trees in the distance, but going towards them always find they're only mirages. Now, we all know about the animal realm because we can see it all around us. This is the third state that we have the freedom of not being born into. This realm includes all the living beings that are not humans: insects, fish, birds, reptiles, mammals, and so on. It doesn't include trees and plants, for Buddhism does not see plant life as sentient, as having consciousness. The main fault with being born an animal is stupidity, in the sense that animals are very instinctual and don't have the ability to plan for the future or practice to free themselves from suffering. They can't practice the Dharma, so being born as an animal is seen in Buddhism as a great disadvantage. Although some people wish to be born as a cat and dog, thinking that life would be much easier as a pet than as a human. Such people don't really understand the difficulties of being an animal, and especially that being born an animal does not necessarily mean you'll be coddled by some doting human. Many, many cats and dogs will never be a pet, but will have to fight for their food and territory, always being fearful of other animals and of humans, being at the mercy of the weather and parasites. And I think you can probably think of many other sufferings that the multitudes of non-pet animals go through. Generally, it's not a happy life. Then the fourth freedom or leisure is not being born as a god or an asura. Asuras are beings that are very competitive and envious and are always fighting for some gain for themselves. They particularly fight with the gods, who are basically beings in a state of very little suffering, so do not practice the Dharma because they're so caught up in their pleasures. So again, being born in either of these two states, probably though not necessarily, means that you will not put any time into practicing the Dharma. In our world, I guess you could find a rough parallel with the top and middle managements of a corporate conglomerate. The top management, with all their wealth, pleasures and status, are like the gods, and the middle managers, who are always fighting to appear better than their peers and stabbing their bosses in the back to get promotion, are like the asuras. Unfortunately for the asuras, when they fight the gods, they inevitably lose, as they do not have the power of the gods. It really does sound like some of our business hierarchies, doesn't it? In our last discussion of the leisures and endowments we need for practice, I mentioned a story of a New Zealander traveling somewhere overseas who went to pay respects to a high Tibetan Lama. When the Lama heard that this visitor was from New Zealand, he said, "Oh, that's a barbarian land." Now, he didn't mean that New Zealanders all went around in animal skins clubbing each other around the head and grunting, "Huh, huh." He meant that New Zealand was a country where you couldn't find any Buddhist teachings. Either this happened a long time ago, or the Lama really didn't know much about New Zealand, for actually the Buddha's teachings have been here at least since the early part of last century, even though they were not much practiced until the 50s and 60s. But anyway, the fifth freedom is not being born in a land such as the Lama thought New Zealand was. Then also, if we have mental or physical deficiencies, it's difficult to really practice. Someone with Down syndrome, for instance, will have little hope of progressing through the teachings. And that is the sixth freedom, the freedom from being born with physical or mental deficiencies. And then the seventh is freedom from being born in a time when the Buddha has not come. Buddhas only appear in the world occasionally, and according to Buddhist cosmology, during long periods, neither any Buddha nor his teachings are around anymore. We've been born in a time when the Buddha has come and his teachings are still widely available. So we have this particular freedom. And finally, the last freedom or leisure is that we're not born into a situation where the views are contradictory to the Buddha's teachings. For instance, if we'd been born into a family in Iran, even though we might know of and like the Buddha's teachings, we would in all probability not be allowed to study or practice them, because Buddhist beliefs are so contradictory to Islam. Now let's look at the endowments. By endowments, we mean the fortunate circumstances that allow us to practice the Dharma without much hindrance. And the texts talk in particular of 10 such endowments. I like to remember the 10 through a kind of mnemonic that goes, "Human born in a central land, with all faculties and having faith, without the heinous actions. The Buddha has come, he has taught, the teachings remain and are followed. There are benefactors." Which probably sounds confusing. So let's go through them one by one to get some sense out of them. Human born means that we have been born in the best situation to practice the Dharma. As I explained earlier, the obstacles in all the other realms are so great that it's much harder to practice than in our present situation. It's said in the teachings that humans generally have the right mix of pleasure and misery, as well as the right mental and physical makeup to really appreciate what the Buddha was talking about. So we're in the best position to make spiritual progress. Then, when I talk about being born in a central land, I mean a country in which the Buddha's teachings are established. Tibet and Sri Lanka are central lands, but Afghanistan is not, although it used to be. Nowadays, New Zealand can be thought of as a central land because many Buddhist traditions and temples are now found here. Though, say, 50 or 100 years ago, not many people here even knew what Buddhism was. Essentially, a central land is one where monks and nuns live, practice, and are able to spread the teachings. And that is now certainly true of New Zealand, especially in Auckland, where lots of temples have sprung up. Having all faculties refers to not being deaf, dumb, blind, and so on. It also means not being mentally deficient. In fact, if all our organs and our mind function normally, we are regarded as having all faculties. Lacking any of these, we would find it much harder to listen to the teachings and integrate them into our lives, or even sustain a continuous, concentrated practice. So that is why having all your faculties is necessary for progress in the Dharma. Of course, if you have all your faculties but have no faith in the Buddha, you are unlikely to want to learn about or practice the Buddha's teachings. In fact, you may well just dismiss them. So the next endowment is having faith. We have to be careful, though, when we're talking about faith in a Buddhist context, because the Buddha was quite emphatic that whatever faith we have should be based on sound reasoning and close investigation. In one famous verse, the Buddha told those who wished to follow his teachings to first scrutinize them with the same rigor as someone would test gold before buying it. O monks, the Buddha said, just as a goldsmith tests his gold by melting, cutting, and rubbing, sages accept my teachings after full examination, not just out of devotion. So we do not follow Buddhist teachings or teachers just because they may appeal to us in some emotional way, but because we have diligently examined them and decided they are right for us. Only then can we have the faith that the Buddha is an accurate and truthful teacher, that if we practice what he says, we will eventually free ourselves from suffering, and that others who have already practiced and realized the teachings will be able to assist us on the way. Only with such firm faith can we be sure that if we practice the Buddha's teachings, we will eventually attain the result. Even His Holiness the Dalai Lama does not encourage people to swap their traditional religion for Buddhism without very serious consideration. Only if we've really thought deeply and done lots of analysis should we consider giving up one religion for another, he says. And then we must be very careful not to disparage our previous religion in any way, for that just creates obstacles on our spiritual path. Then on to the heinous actions. In terms of heavy negativities that will reap very powerful negative effects, five is said to be the worst. They are called the heinous actions, for without any purification, these actions will send us at the end of this life straight into a hell realm, without any hope of an intervening interval or life. The five are killing your father or mother, killing an arhat, drawing blood from a Buddha, and causing a schism within the Sangha community. Luckily, it's unlikely that we will commit any of these, though we really can't say who is an arhat or a Buddha, so we should still be careful. It may be easier to create a schism within the community of monks and nuns, so we must also be careful about what we say and always try to encourage harmony among the Sangha. Some Buddhist schools say that if you create any of these five actions, it is impossible to purify the negative karma, but other schools say it is possible. But anyway, they're pretty serious actions, so we should at all costs try to avoid them. At this point in my mnemonic, we've got up to where I say, the Buddha has come, he has taught, the teachings remain and are followed. There are benefactors. A stanza that indicates the final five endowments. The first is that the Buddha has come. This means that he is born into our world system in a time when we can appreciate his teachings. You could argue that for us the Buddha hasn't actually come here because he died a very long time ago. But as I pointed out in our earlier discussion of this point in the last series of programs, what the Buddha taught is still with us through the kindness of those who have studied and meditated on those teachings, gained realizations, and then passed their experience on to us. So although we may no longer have the flesh and blood Shakyamuni with us, we do have people who can quite adequately represent him as if he was here. They have the same power as the Buddha to lead us to enlightenment. Then my little verse says, he has taught. Shakyamuni was the fourth Buddha in this world system, and rumor has it that a total of 1,000 will duly appear here. For one reason or another, some Buddhas do not teach, and even Shakyamuni nearly didn't. For you will remember that he sat under the Bodhi tree for 6 weeks after becoming enlightened, wondering whether it would be worthwhile telling others about his enlightenment and how to get there. He thought people would never understand what he was talking about. However, in due course, he was persuaded to teach, and so spent the next 45 years laying the basis in India for what we now know as Buddhism. And that leads to that part of the mnemonic that says the teachings remain. For sure, the Buddha's teachings will one day have disappeared from our world. Even the Buddha himself predicted this. The teachings are as subject to impermanence and change as everything else, and so we cannot expect them to remain forever. However, some 2,600 years after he taught, the teachings are still with us, even though they have all but died out in their home country, India. Perhaps in New Zealand, we're particularly fortunate because the West doesn't yet have its own brand of Buddhism, so we can examine the Buddhist practices of each of the traditions and see which one suits our own mind the best. Someone from Sri Lanka, for instance, will have been brought up in the Sri Lankan tradition and will probably not even think of changing to, say, the Tibetan tradition. It will be easier just to follow their own tradition. We in the West still have a wider choice. But even though that is true, we're very fortunate that people of various traditions still follow the Dharma. For if it still existed, say, in some library archives, but was not followed, it would be difficult for anyone to follow. Not only do we have the Buddha and his disciples as our role models, but we also have the highly accomplished masters and monks to guide us, and even just ordinary monks to help us when we need it. Just imagine how hard it would be if you were the only Buddhist on the planet. And having other followers to support us is really very helpful for our practice. Sometimes people tell me about reading Buddhist books and being inspired to practice meditation. So they start sitting cross-legged on a cushion to watch their mind or breath, but soon all sorts of problems arise. Their minds will not settle down, they don't really know what they're trying to achieve, their expectations are high, and so on. The problem is that they're trying to do the work all on their own without any real guidance or clarity. So naturally difficulties arise. My almost stock answer to them is to find and join a meditation class with an experienced teacher where they can discuss their problems, learn from the questions and difficulties of other meditators, and feed off the group energy for continued inspiration. It's very difficult to keep a practice going all by yourself. Not only do you have to do the work, but you have to keep your own inspiration going. And believe me, the mind is a tricky thing when it comes to doing something it doesn't want to. It will find all sorts of excuses and delaying tactics if it wants to. If you join others in practice at least once a week, you will find that not only will many doubts and uncertainties be cleared, but you will be inspired to continue the practice much more easily. The mind will find less opportunity to play its usual tricks of procrastination and so on. And so the 10th and final endowment is that we have many benefactors who we can rely on in our practice. For instance, if you want to go on retreat in New Zealand, it's quite easy to find people who will give you a good place to stay, food and all the other necessities. So it's not difficult to do a Buddhist retreat in this country. If you lived in Iran, for instance, I imagine it would be much more tricky, especially if you're a woman. Actually, one Tibetan master who has now died has said that New Zealand has the best conditions in the world to practice the Dharma. So those are all the conditions that Shantideva is talking about in this verse. Of course, we can actually practice the Dharma in any situation if we really put our mind to it. In the communist prisons of China, monks were forbidden to practice on the pain of very severe punishment, but they still found ways to do so. In fact, I read in Fire Under the Snow a book about one man's dreadful experiences at the hands of the communists, that the guards of the prison thought the Tibetans were completely stupid because they would sit blankly gazing at the ground or into outer space. Actually, though they looked shut off from the world, they were going through their practices in their heads, and some of the masters even said that their prison experience was helpful in deepening their practice. However, most of us ordinary folk need the best conditions we can muster. I certainly don't think I would be able to get much practice done in a communist prison with guards just waiting for the opportunity to make life extremely difficult. Just to run through the 18 conditions that Shantideva is talking about under leisure and endowment, they are freedom from being born in the hell realms, the animal, preta, or god realms, freedom from having a physical or mental disability, freedom from being born in what the Tibetans like to call a barbarian land, or in a time when the Buddha has not come, and finally, freedom from being born in a place like Iran, where the views are contradictory to Buddhism. Those are the 8 freedoms. The other 10, called endowments, are, as my mnemonic says, human born in a central land with all faculties and having faith without the heinous crimes. The Buddha has come, he has taught, the teachings remain and are followed. There are benefactors. We've spent most of this program explaining one line in Shantideva's verse, which you might remember goes like this. Leisure and endowment are very hard to find, and since they accomplish what is meaningful for man, if I do not take advantage of them now, how will such a perfect opportunity come about again? In the rest of the verse, Shantideva says that attaining all the conditions to be able to practice the Dharma is very difficult, because there are so many various states we can be born into that do not even have one or two of these conditions, never mind all of them. The Buddha said that just gaining a human life is extremely hard, never mind gaining a human life with the conditions to encounter and practice the Dharma. We have such a huge store of negative karma, which we add to every day and hardly ever purify, that the chances of getting this opportunity again are very slim. You've probably heard of the analogy of the turtle who lives at the bottom of a vast and deep ocean and who comes up for air once every 100 years. On the top of the ocean floats a yolk. The Buddha said that to get a precious human rebirth is more difficult than for the turtle to come up for air and to put its head through the yolk. So we might think that because Buddhism is the third largest religion in the world, it is easy to become a Buddhist and follow the teachings. Seen in a larger context, taking into account all the various rebirths we can take and all the conditions we can be born into, the odds of it happening are very small. Just think of being a practicing Buddhist in amongst all the animals, insects, reptiles, birds, fish, amoeba, and so on. And that's just thinking of this world that we're used to. In the Buddhist cosmology, there are many other states to be born into. Thinking of all that, maybe we can see how hard it is. So, says Shantideva, having obtained this opportunity now, we would be much more than foolish to waste it by not following the Dharma. If we could be sure of getting such an opportunity again and again, it wouldn't matter so much being relaxed about practice now. But the fact is that we're unlikely to get it again for a very long time, maybe eons, if we do not practice now. So we should use this short time we have as best we can. Of course, it is unlikely that most of us will be able to be enlightened in this life, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't do as much practice as possible, or at least try to create the causes to get this opportunity in other lives, so we can progress spiritually. This is what Shantideva means by making this life meaningful. And now, with that, I must leave you. Please take a moment to dedicate any positive energy from this program to the enlightenment of yourself and all beings. Thank you for joining us today, and please do so again next week, when we will continue with this text. Have a wonderful week. I hope you're able to practice well and keep a calm and peaceful mind. And now, goodbye.